Welcome to the Sleep Podcast with me, Mitchell Willis, and him, Michael Hall.
It's good to be back.
It's wonderful to be back. It's been a long, long time, hasn't it?
It has, yeah. Life, as we know it, has got in the way over the last few weeks. And some people, some sceptics may believe that may have something to do with the fact that our collective football teams have been utter rubbish for the last few weeks. And the fact that we're both back after a win for both of those teams is pure coincidence, we must admit. But yeah, we've missed a lot, haven't we?
We have missed a lot. It's it's been eventful. I'd say we've very much still got a title race on our hands, although it's been reduced to two horses, maybe. Behind them, there's real battle for Champions League places as well, and a possible North London shootout in the offing, as well as all sorts of shenanigans at Chelsea. And we've missed the Carabao Cup, so I think there's a little bit of catching up to do on that as well. Player revolts and Sarri being Sarri, I think.
We'll get to that in due course. We've also got to talk about Manchester United, and they're kind of what they should be, or are they?
Yeah, there's definitely some question marks.
There are indeed, and we'll obviously find out shortly about what's going on at Old Trafford, as well as a new manager for the Premier League in somebody that a lot of us know from his previous appointments, Brendan Rodgers returning. And obviously there's a big battle at the bottom where there's not really been a huge amount of movement, but there's been quite a lot of success for teams down there of late. So we've got a huge amount to talk about, and we've also got the Championship to talk about, which I know you're going to want to have your say on, quite rightly.
Yes, I think there's a little bit to talk about after this weekend. We'll get to that. Updates from Europe, Portugal, and might even mention fantasy football for good measure.
I think we should do. I think that would be a lovely way to bookend the show.
Me too. Right, we need to crack on. What better place to start than at the top of the Premier League, which is where Manchester City currently sit, smiling down on the rest of the league following their win against Watford this weekend, and a 3-1 win thanks to a Raheem Sterling hat-trick.
Yeah, and it's been a few games for Manchester City where it did start to feel a little bit cagey, and teams were maybe starting to figure out the way that they play. And I don't know whether it was just nerves or fatigue, or whether it's the pressure of Liverpool still being up there that had got the better of them. But I think you look at the way that they've performed in the first half in this game, and they weren't really where they needed to be. Watford went there with a game plan. They put 11 men behind the ball. They made changes, and I, for one, thought it would just be a routine victory for Manchester City. I didn't, for any particular length of time, consider that Watford might be able to frustrate them or get anything out of the game. And I think when you've got players like Raheem Sterling in your side, you always have the opportunity, regardless of the tactics of the other team, to create chances. And obviously we saw that in spades on Saturday.
That's the thing with City, more so than ever this season. They seem to have someone else that can deliver and unlock the door. And I think Mahrez over the last few weeks has shone. You know, he didn't really get the nod for the first half of the season. And, you know, I think we've seen managers more and more so bedding players into squads. You know, Liverpool have done it quite a lot over the last couple of years. And similar with Manchester City, you know, Bernardo Silva didn't play a huge amount last season, but he's a bit of a focal point for them this year. Whereas Mahrez came in, massive money, huge reputation already in the league as well. And they were content to just kind of leave him out and drip feed him through into it, so that he got used to the way that they played, the demands of what Pep wanted from him. And I think he's shone over the last few weeks, and he showed that on Saturday as well. And I think alongside that, Aguero's having as good a season as he's had for the last few years as well. And as you say, Raheem Sterling, who offers them something different, I think he's becoming more and more consistent with that as well now, and he's scoring a few different types of goals. And I think that's the key. You know, teams are figuring out the way that they can stop Manchester City in the generic way of stopping them from getting the ball at the byline, drilling it across and tapping it in. That said, that still happened on Saturday.
It did, and we need to address what on earth happened for that first goal, because it wasn't as clear-cut as many thought. Firstly, it was disallowed, and then it wasn't disallowed, and for some reason it wasn't disallowed, because it definitely should have been disallowed.
Yeah, I mean, you could see Sterling explaining it to, I think it was Andre Gray, and he was kind of nodded along, and he was like, yeah, that maybe that does make sense. I dread to think what he told him. He must have just told him a pack of shit, because for all intents and purposes, he was very much offside.
And he was very much interfering with play, and that's the rule when it comes to this phase of play within the game. And I understand where the idea of some Manchester City fans comes from, that the goal should have stood, but when you look at it from the point of view that as soon as the defender kicks it against Sterling, I mean, he's active because he's right next to the defender, and if he wasn't, then the defender wouldn't have gone for the ball. He would have just let it go out of play. And that's where, obviously, VAR will come in and obviously clear things up next season. But in that case, I think that the referees sometimes need to have a little bit more faith in the linesman. And I know that it's their final decision. And I know that in this case, the referee was a lot closer to the incident, but the linesman's been made to look like a fool there.
Yep.
Because his decision's been overturned, despite the fact that was the correct one. And we've seen it a lot in recent weeks in the Premier League, and it's almost like referees know that VAR's coming in next season, so they're starting to make more mistakes so that people will actually be more
grateful of the technology.
Absolutely, right. And that's it. I think more people are becoming pro-VAR on the back of recent decisions, and that isn't where we should be, but it's where we find ourselves.
Is it highlighted more, though, because we know it's coming in?
I don't think so.
Is it still the same amount of mistakes that are being made?
I genuinely think there have been more, and I'll come on to talk about this in a couple of games that we're going to discuss, but there's been some horrendous refereeing decisions of late, and it's been talked about more and more. And the fact that we had VAR in the World Cup, and you didn't find us talking too much towards the end of last season about the difference in decisions and the difference in quality of referees. So it's difficult to say what it is. You wonder whether there's a mindset among referees that actually, well, we're going to have this to fall back on next season so we can take our foot off a little bit. But it's disappointing because you get into the crucial end of the season where it really could make a difference. And you look at the Liverpool game versus what happened in the Manchester City game, and obviously they went behind to a really, really bad decision, a foul on the goalkeeper which should have been given. And if Burnley had gone on to win that game and Manchester City had profited from a poor refereeing decision going in their favour on Saturday, then you'd have a much bigger gap, and you could say that's the title one there and then. So it's clear that something needs to be done, something is going to be done, but it doesn't mean that they can just have the rest of the season off.
Absolutely. Well, we move on nicely to Liverpool, and yeah, I mean, a 4-2 win, and as you say, they went behind, and, you know, I'm all for letting goalkeepers have that little bit more physicality around them. You know, we see and quite often complain that they are very, very overprotected, but this was probably one example where it couldn't have been further away from it, could it?
No, and you don't blame Alisson for getting booked in this scenario, because it was a foul, it was a clear foul, he was completely impeded and unable to get to the ball, and I mean... they credited Ashley Westwood with the goal. It's not really, I mean, it's his goal in terms of the fact that nobody else has touched it between him touching it and it going in the goal, but it should not have been given, and straight away it put Liverpool on the back foot. But obviously they were able to come back and score quickly, and I thought that was massive. The fact that they got on level terms within, I think it was about 10 minutes after they conceded, allowed them then to almost just reset and go again, and going in ahead at half time would have made a big difference psychologically, because again, as we've seen with Manchester City in some games this season, Liverpool have struggled of late to put teams away, especially teams that they should be beating.
Yeah, I think you have to admire how clinical they were at the weekend, because I think probably three of the goals came from mistakes, and ultimately they were just in the right position where they could just put them away. And I think I was impressed from that perspective. Like you say, I don't think it was a vintage performance by any stretch, but, you know, they forced the errors with the high press, and it wasn't just, you know, Burnley made stupid mistakes. It was actually as a result of some hard work done by Liverpool, and that's obviously what Jurgen Klopp has built his team around over the last few years, and they showed that at the weekend. And I think Lallana was called out for having a really good game, and I think he did make a bit of a difference as well. I think he led that press at times, and he was offering them something different on the ball as well.
I think he does offer something different. I think the issue is that the type of game that Liverpool play isn't always going to be suited to them. In games against teams who do sit in, like this one against Burnley, he was always going to be a valuable asset because of the way that he manipulates the football outside the penalty area. Sometimes you see sides go side to side and then back and back, and they're trying to break down a defence like that, whereas Lallana's got quick enough feet to be able to take the ball past a player, commit a couple of defenders, which then leaves space for somebody else. And you don't always see that with footballers nowadays. They're more about, like you said about Manchester City, driving to the byline, getting the ball into the middle for an easy tap-in. And Lallana is one of those players, similar to David Silva, not obviously with identical attributes, but he can put his foot on the ball and really look for a pass by, like I say, moving defenders around. So it's a great person to have back for Liverpool at this stage of the season, and you would imagine that he's probably not going to start a huge amount of games, but in the running he could be crucial to their chances of staying on Manchester City's coattails or overtaking them, because I think the next time they play, I think Liverpool play first.
Yeah, well, you know, a win's a win. They've just got to keep plugging away, and I think they have to enjoy it as well. You know, we, as you've just said, we've seen Liverpool play second quite a lot, and I think that probably will continue as well. And you wonder what it does for them psychologically, because I think whether it is them playing first or second, it must play a part depending on when you're playing. And I think, you know, there's been the odd excuse that's been used over the last few weeks for poorer performances, and you just wonder what the mindset is. You kind of just want to say, just go out and play your game and enjoy it, because 9 times out of 10 you're probably going to beat most of the teams in the Premier League.
Yeah, I think Jurgen Klopp's been ruffled recently. I think you saw the interview after the Everton game where he blamed the wind, and a lot's been made of that. But not only that, the spiky response to the reporter's question who asked them about whether they should have been more attack-minded in that game, and it did show a little bit of pressure, and it's probably the first time that he's shown that outside the club. You don't know the conversations that have gone on in-house, but he's got to be careful, because he's created this image of himself since coming into English football that he is a media darling, that he gets on with everybody within the media because of the way that he treats journalists and the way that he talks about football. It's all very positive and outgoing, and he likes to talk as one of the people, and you saw a strain in that relationship at that point, and he's got to be careful that that doesn't filter its way down to the players, because if they see that the person who's always kept them out of the limelight is starting to lose it a little bit, then it will be very easy for them to do the same. So it's probably the biggest 3 months of Jurgen Klopp's career now. We obviously saw what he was able to do over in Germany, and that was massive. But Liverpool haven't won a first division title since, I think a lot of people are aware, it's been over 20 years. Yep. And when you look at that record versus Dortmund's record, and obviously Dortmund are flying high at the moment, they will continually challenge Bayern. Liverpool have only really had one or two seasons over the last 20-25 years where they have challenged, and that's why they've got to ensure that they try and get over the line this season, because if not, then they will start to be labelled, as Newcastle were in the 90s, as a team who were always going to get in a position to go on and win it, but then ended up bottling it. And that will be something that Klopp will want to put at the back of his mind, but unfortunately, like I said, it seems to be something that keeps brewing. So it's a good result. It's probably not the best performance, and I think at this stage of the season, that's probably all that matters.
It's a formality, but who wins the title? We have to ask it every week.
Well, it's been a few weeks, hasn't it, since we've discussed it, and I think that last time we were on, the gap was a lot bigger and it was in Liverpool's favour, so it's only right that we address it at the moment. I've said Manchester City all season, and it wouldn't be right for me to change my mind now because of a couple of performances, and I still believe that that will be the case. There's two massive games, and obviously I think Manchester City have got to play Manchester United and they've got to play Tottenham, and I think if they get 4 points from those two games, then that'll be enough, because Liverpool have also got Spurs to play, and all the time that both sides stay in the Champions League, it probably keeps them level pegging. It doesn't give an advantage to either side, and obviously we'll see how Liverpool get on this week. If they are to be knocked out by Bayern Munich, I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing.
No, I agree. I would go Manchester City as well, but I'm excited about a title race, to be honest. This genuinely could go to the last game of the season, and I'd quite like it to twist a lot in that time as well. I think it'd be a lot more interesting.
Exactly. We need to quickly mention Burnley before we move on, because obviously there were two teams on the pitch on Sunday. They've dropped down to 17th due to results of other sides, and as a Burnley fan, you'd be pretty devastated this weekend, because four of the five sides around you won, and that's not great. But when you consider their recent run, do you think they'll still have enough? Do you think they'll still stay up?
Yeah, I think, you know, they've shown over the last 2 months that they have something about them. I still don't necessarily think they've got the quality that others have got around them, but they clearly have some sort of drive and desire, and, you know, we've seen Tom Heaton put in some absolute match-winning performances as well over the last few months, and I think in theory that should be enough. But as you say, you know, there's a lot of dependency on what happens elsewhere as well, and I think that's going to be an interesting one to see how they get on with the challenge psychologically, because They have been, you know, certainly last year they were a lot more used to being at the top half of the table, and I think, you know, from that perspective, they had a gap where they could pretty much just sit on their asses for 3 months and not be too fussed about it, whereas now they need to fight.
They do indeed. Talking of fights, it was Arsenal against Manchester United, and this weekend was lit up by this game. It was a bit of an odd one, because I think a lot more of us expected a bit more of a battle, especially from the away side. Obviously, 2-0 on paper looks quite comfortable, and I think it doesn't really tell the full story. Manchester United created a lot of chances, but they were unable to finish them, and Arsenal took the chances, which is something that we really haven't seen them do that much of late. And I think that Arsenal will probably take more away from this game than Manchester United will. I think, especially after what happened against PSG in the week, it was always going to be difficult to get themselves up for this one, both physically and mentally. So possibly a fair result, but it just shows how tight, like you said at the top of the show, the run-in for those Champions League places is going to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was one of Manchester United's best performances since Solskjaer's come in, certainly after first half an hour, which wasn't great. And, you know, they created plenty of chances and they just couldn't break down Arsenal. And, you know, you have to give credit to Arsenal. You know, the first goal wasn't great. It was speculative, to say the least. And obviously, the penalties are a poor one to concede, and it possibly wasn't a penalty, but if you put yourself in that situation, you open yourself up to have the decision against you. And I think, you know, from that perspective, Arsenal have probably got a little bit lucky. Manchester United haven't put their chances away, but they were relatively well organised. And I think if you look at the bigger picture, you know, they'll be disappointed not to have taken the points against Spurs last week. There's glimpses that they're kind of getting there, and they might just falter every kind of two or three games where it just holds them back a little bit, but they're in there. You know, they're in the race for the top four, and that's huge credit to them, because they haven't really wowed anyone this season. They've had injuries. They're still getting used to the whole setup behind the scenes and trying to implement the changes. And I think to still be in there at this point in the season is huge, huge credit to them and Emery.
Not only that, but if you look at the points differential between this season and last, they've got 12 points more at this stage than they had this time last season, and that's massive when you consider that Arsenal and Arsene Wenger were normally a lot better in the second half of the season as well. So it has to be seen as progress. I understand that obviously the Europa League result against Rennes last week wasn't what they wanted. I think if they'd have ended up losing that game 2-1, they would have been pretty confident of overturning it. But obviously going down 3-1 gives them a bit of a mountain to climb, and having a sending off in that game didn't help them. But I think we saw a lot of what Unai Emery brings in terms of organisation in this game. I think tactically he got it absolutely spot on in patches. There were obviously times where Manchester United were able to implement their own style, which allowed them to get through the Arsenal defence, but they didn't look too uncomfortable throughout the game. And I don't think that's ever something that we were able to say about Arsene Wenger when he was in charge at Arsenal. We often went through periods where you'd see them and think it's the same old Arsenal. I think in Emery they've got somebody who's able to change things around, and we've talked a lot this season about Sarri ball and how rigid his tactics seem to be. Emery seems to be somebody who's able to get the best out of different groups of players in different scenarios, and I thought it was a really impressive performance from them. And like I say, I think given that they got 3 points against Manchester United, 1 point against Tottenham last week, and they should have had all three last week, that 4 points could be the difference when it comes to the end of the season, given that they've managed to stop their rivals picking up 6 points there.
Quick word on Manchester United, actually. They obviously had an incredible result in the week at PSG. It's an interesting decision for the penalty, it's fair to say, but to watch Rashford put that away with the pressure on him, such kind of maturity as well, was really impressive. And I think, you know, you have to give them a huge amount of credit under Solskjaer as well. He's done a fantastic job, and I think he's shown that he's got some tactical nous, but more than anything, he's kind of brought a bit of spirit back to the club, and he's got them going again. And for me, I think you're hard-pressed to look at any reason why he shouldn't get the job on a full-time basis.
No, you're absolutely right. He should get the job. I think, just to sort of add to your point there, the fact that he's brought in some of the youth team players of late to play in these big games shows the faith that he's got in the system at Manchester United, and that will do wonders for the kids that are coming through at that football club, because there is clearly a pathway there. You've seen it in recent years with the likes of Lingard and Rashford, and hopefully there'll be another couple coming off the conveyor belt and they'll be able to get back to the way that they brought players through 20, 30 years ago.
Absolutely, and that win means that, you know, Arsenal did overtake Manchester United, and they're now just a point behind Spurs, and We'll start with them, following their 2-1 defeat at Southampton, because I'm sure you're desperate to wax lyrical about Southampton, but I think we have to look at the full game. Spurs should have been 1 or 2 up in the first 20 minutes or so, but they just couldn't apply the finishing touch, which you don't necessarily expect from them. They're generally fairly clinical. You look at someone like Harry Kane, and he doesn't really seem to miss, does he?
No, but I mean, he did have a couple of good chances in the first half. There was a half volley from the edge of the area which flashed past Angus Gunn's goal, and there was one that he did about 3 kick-ups with his back before taking over his shoulder, which obviously went high and wide. But I think that Tottenham probably would have thought at half-time they would comfortably win that game, because Southampton got nowhere near them. It looked like third against fourth bottom.
So are they looking kind of complacent? Have they got the wrong attitude at the moment, as I think Pochettino touched on?
Well, he talked about arrogance, and I personally think that arrogance is a good thing in football, especially a top four side. You need to be arrogant in games. You need to have the self-belief that you are better than another side, because that could be the extra 5-10% that you need. But I think it was more game management in this one. They didn't manage the threat from Southampton properly. They didn't recognise the substitutions that were made at half time. And I think that the players obviously have to take some responsibility for that. But going away to Dortmund in midweek, playing 90 minutes there against a very good side, probably took a lot out of Tottenham. And maybe Hasenhüttl recognised that and thought, actually, it's not worth doing this from the start, because they'll probably have a decent sort of hour in them. And they certainly did fade. But some of the Tottenham players also need to hold their hands up for the individual mistakes that were made during the game. Danny Rose obviously had a complete and utter melting brain moment for the first goal, where he let the ball roll across the 6-yard box and then tried to dummy it, presumably thinking he could start an attack. And obviously Jan Valery's there just to tap it in. And then for the second goal, they lost the ball on the edge of the Southampton penalty area, and within 2 or 3 passes, Southampton were up the other end of the pitch. And obviously, Stuart Armstrong does very well to get in behind Kyle Walker-Peters, but it's just a poor decision at that point to bring him down. I think you've got to consider that ball's coming across. You're going to have more chance to get goal side at that stage, because Armstrong's got to take a touch. He's not going to take it from 30 yards out. He's not going to shoot at that point. And I think they let themselves down. I think that should have been a red card. I'm not sure how Kevin Friend has not seen that. He's the last man, and he's denying a goal-scoring opportunity. And then Moussa Sissoko in the corner towards the end of the game, he shows his frustration. And Tottenham kind of got away with it a little bit when you consider that they came away without any points. They could have come away with suspensions, and that's what will be the most displeasing thing from a Pochettino point of view, is that his side just crumbled, and that's not what you want when you've got so much to play for between now and the end of the season.
I think it's worth looking at the bigger picture as well, because last time we recorded, Spurs were still in the title race. You know, we were talking about them potentially winning the league, and now they're possibly not even going to make the Champions League. And you know, we've seen the stadium now. It looks fantastic. It looks a great place to go and watch football. And you know, you want to be seeing the likes of Real Madrid and Barcelona go in there, not the Armenian champions or whatever. And I think it would be a huge, huge disappointment and a huge blow to them financially, commercially, to not make the top four.
And that's the reality of it, though, isn't it? If you do go on a bad run, you've got 3 sides below you in Manchester United, Arsenal. 2 sides below you in Manchester United and Arsenal, who are going to be straight on your heels. And that's the situation that Tottenham find themselves in. And it may be that the Champions League this season, the fact that they've gone so far in it, could be the detriment to what happens next season. But we've got to talk about Southampton, Mitch.
Well, I thought we'd just brush over it.
Absolutely not. Come on now. It's taken us 3 weeks to record an episode. It's taken us 3 weeks to get both of our sides to win. I obviously need to give Southampton a lot of credit for the second half performance. I think Ralph Hasenhüttl,
the sacking of Mark Hughes,
yeah, that for sure. But it comes down to who they brought in, and there's definitely been green shoots over the past 2 or 3 months that he's been there. But the issue is we're still down there, and we only have a 2-point lead over Cardiff. But I think there were signs in the second half performance of a completely different side to the one that we saw in the first half of the season. They were able to hold on to the lead when they took it. They were able to come back from a goal down to one of the best sides in the country. And they went toe-to-toe with Tottenham and created a lot in the second half. Nathan Redmond should have scored 2 or 3 gilt-edge chances. And I thought Ryan Bertrand had a really good game as well. And they just looked like a different animal under Hasenhüttl. But the issue still remains that down there are probably four or five teams who could still go down. And the fact that Brighton and Burnley obviously had looked better in the last couple of games put more pressure on Southampton and Cardiff, and obviously they've both won this weekend. Brighton got the win as well, and I don't think it's a terrible thing that Brighton did beat Palace on midday on Saturday, because it meant that Cardiff and Southampton knew what they had to do. Yeah. If they didn't get anything from their games, then they would have found themselves in a battle between the two of them, and it just showed what a little bit of confidence gives you. The performance against Manchester United away at Old Trafford last week, the players took something from that, and I know that they didn't obviously get any points from it, but they were able to take confidence into this game, and I think that showed in the second half.
Absolutely. You mentioned Cardiff there. They beat West Ham 2-0, and they're very much still plugging away. And, you know, this win, as we say, the weekend on reflection was massive for them. Although still in the relegation zone, they're still very much in amongst it. And, you know, again, as you say, with the results going the other way, they could have been not necessarily out of it, but, you know, they've got a lot of ground to make up if they don't win this game.
You're absolutely right, yeah. If they hadn't won here then, or even picked up a point, then they would have been 6 points behind, essentially, because both yep. Burnley and Southampton have got a better goal difference from them. So that leaves Cardiff needing to win two games for parity with the teams that are above them. And given that four of the last eight games are against sides in the top six, that's going to be a pretty tough order. So it was a crucial game to win this one. The bonus from a Cardiff point of view is that the other four games that they've got in the last eight are against Brighton, Crystal Palace, Burnley and Fulham. So yep. you would back them to win at least two of those games. And it could be enough when you look, I think they're on 28 points now. Another two wins could feasibly be enough. 34 points is a low total to stay up with, but it's possible because, like I say, there are teams down there who are playing one another, and all it takes is for a draw between Brighton and Southampton, and then if Cardiff win, then look at where they are. They're out of the bottom three.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you look at Neil Warnock, he thrives in this situation as well, and you know he will relish the opportunity to beat the teams around them and you know not only just climb above them or climb up nearer to them to bring them into it. And I think the more teams that are in there, he's getting more and more excited by it. And I think, you know, there's plenty of reports about Neil Warnock this week, and the players are potentially losing faith in him. But, you know, for me, I'd be sticking with him all the way because he knows the situation as well or better than anybody else, and he's the man you want fighting for you.
Absolutely right. And they're only 6 points behind Newcastle in 13th, so it just shows that it started to bunch up a little bit again down there. There was a clear gap between certain sides, but obviously Crystal Palace losing on the weekend and Burnley losing at Liverpool, it does make it more interesting from a Cardiff City point of view, and it just wouldn't surprise me if they were still there in the last couple of games, still trying to evade the drop.
Not surprised they won, for me, to be honest. You know, West Ham are consistently as inconsistent as ever, and you know they seem to win the games at home, turn up against the big teams, but you can just almost guarantee they just don't fancy the trips to the likes of Cardiff. And you know that obviously saw Cardiff put in possibly one of their best performances of the season as a result of that. You know, they're planting the ball and created a lot. But just a quick word on West Ham. For you know, we know what they are, we know where they're going to end up in the league. They're going to finish 9th or 10th, and they've had one standout player. They've had a few very good new signings, but I think Declan Rice has come into his own this year, and he's obviously committed to England in the last few weeks. I just wanted to get your thoughts on that, really.
I think it's a positive thing from England's point of view because you've got another good young player coming through the ranks, and that can only benefit them in the long term. I think the problem from his point of view is the fact that there are players who are better than him at the moment in his position. If I was Declan Rice, I'd be looking at somebody like Eric Dyer, and knowing how much Eric Dyer played at the World Cup during the summer, it would be, how do I try and oust him from the side? And I think he's probably still got a little way to go because Eric Dyer's playing for a top three side, and he's got a lot of Champions League experience, he's got a lot of international experience, and he can do a job in more than one position. And I know that people have talked about Declan Rice at centre-back at some point in his yep. career, maybe as he gets a little bit older, and it could be that that's where we see him fill in, because you could argue the strength and depth in the England squad isn't necessarily at that sort of position. But great for him, great for his family, and I look forward to seeing whether he gets picked in Gareth Southgate's squad this Wednesday. It'd be quite amusing if he isn't.
Yeah, it would be amusing if he isn't. Anyway, that's all for part one. Join us after the break. We're going to go to the Rough and Tumble Championship.
It promises to be another special Champions League evening, and here to enjoy it all with us are Rio Ferdinand, Steven Gerrard and Ian Wright. All three have had their hands on this trophy, Rio and Steven in Moscow and Istanbul respectively. And Ian, when he walked into the studio this evening... I've been looking forward to that all day.
You should have said when I walked into the studio and grabbed the back of your head.
great.
Welcome back to part two of this week's Weeb podcast, and we are taking that trip to the Championship, and it was eventful, to say the least, and I think there's probably only one place that we can start, and that was at Birmingham City, at St Andrews, and second City Derby. We have to talk about what happened to Jack Grealish, and I've genuinely never felt so uncomfortable watching anything in football. It was an absolute disgrace, and I think even taking my Villa hat off, I still would have had the same reaction, to be honest.
Yeah, it was awful. I mean, I was watching the Liverpool-Burnley game at the time, and you text me, and I thought you were joking. I thought it was something that... I thought maybe he'd scored and somebody had, like, clocked him on in the celebrations or something.
Like a Paul Robinson-type attack.
Yeah, and it's just... Yeah, it's completely shocking to see it, and I think, obviously, since... the incident happened, the perpetrator has been put in jail, and he'll spend, I think, 14 weeks is what he was sentenced to. He'll probably not spend that long in jail, but that's the correct sentence, because that's the legal system in the UK. I think the reason it's so shocking is because it's not something that we've seen for a long time. The only real incident that I can remember is when Chris Kirkland was hit in the face. I think he was playing for Sheffield Wednesday at the time, and somebody ran on the pitch and sort of pushed both hands into his face, and at the time it was similarly discussed, and we talked about what changes could be made. I think it's important to remember that it doesn't happen very often in football. However, look at the knock-on effect. Look at what happened in the Arsenal-Manchester United game later in the day, and that's why we've got to nip it in the bud now, and I don't know how that happens, but I think we need to concentrate more on the reaction and
definitely.
And what happened after that, because Jack Grealish deserves immense credit.
Yeah, I mean, just before I get onto that, just chuck him out of the league. I mean, he had a relatively quiet game, to be honest. And, you know, we struggled to get a foothold in the game. And I think, you know, I texted you before he'd even been punched and said, you know, he's had a really clever first few minutes. And we've seen watching Villa Birmingham games, Keithden Beld. He loves a booking against Villa in particular, but Grealish just he did that thing where he just kicked the ball away just in front of the foot, and he got absolutely nailed in like the second minute, and Keithden Beld got booked. Fantastic bit of play, and that was worryingly, that was for a long period of the game the best thing he did all game. And then you know, after that he's gone on to score the winner. It was a good goal, but his reaction after that, you know, he celebrated with such passion. He went into the fans and got started on again by someone else. And to see his interview after the game, he almost had forgotten about what had happened. You know, he got asked about how his day was, and he just said, "It's the best day of my life. I've captained my club, my boyhood club, and scored the winner here, and it's incredible." And you know, the reporter was trying to get him to say a little bit more, and he just... It's like, these things happen, but I've just gone and done that, so, you know, have a look at that. And, yeah, you know, he's been fantastic for us the last couple of games. He's come back from a three-month layoff. I've said numerous times I really hate the fact that we are becoming a one-man team, but equally, when something like that happens, I'm more than happy for it to happen. And, you know, we've had a few players come on and change the game at the weekend. John McGinn's there and Andre Gray's there. Just injecting a little bit of pace and purpose, and the last 20 minutes, you know, we rightly went on to win the game. It was a little bit nervy at the end. I think the day would have been spoilt had Craig Gardner scored one of the two opportunities he had. He had a bit of a shocker there, but again, literally couldn't care less. He is one of my least favourite human beings, let alone footballers. So, it's not the end of the world for us.
Of course, it's not. And also, I mean, you look at the table now. I know you said a couple of weeks ago that the season was over and that was it.
Yeah.
But you're only 4 points outside the playoffs. You play in Nottingham Forest tomorrow night, and obviously they're 2 points and one place above you. You win that game, then it could be back on.
It's a huge week. We've got Forest and Middlesbrough at the weekend as well, and you know, we are looking in good form, and I think, you know, we beat Middlesbrough away. We've drawn 5 all with Forest, which is a game that you can't really draw any comparisons to. But yeah, I was very much in the mindset that it was all over, but it's the teams above us that are all keep beating each other as well. It's, you know, that we're being drawn back into it. So yeah, it's exciting times. You know, Grealish scored an absolute belter against Derby last week, a contender for goal of the season, and to beat them 4-0 and be 4-0 up at half time as well was a huge result, and I think that did show that we've definitely got something to offer. But there's plenty more going on as well. You know, we have to move to the top of the league, where very much a 3-way race for the 2 top spots. Norwich and Leeds currently occupy them, but Sheffield United's still in there too, and I want to get your opinion on who you think's going to go up automatically, because realistically, any of those 3 could have the 2 top spots.
I think that Leeds and Norwich will go up automatically. I think the fact that there's a 2-point gap between Leeds and Sheffield United is massive at this stage, and as much as they're all seem to be playing at different points of the weekend, it seems that both Leeds and Norwich are able to win regardless of the circumstance. And I thought initially that Bielsa's Leeds would have gone at this stage. I thought that they would have been too tired, but it seems like they've had a bit of a second wind, and he's galvanised that club. I think since what happened with the whole Spygate thing, I think that's probably done them an immense favour, because it took the pressure off the players and put more on him, and he'll eat that up all day. So yeah, that's the 2 that I'm going for. What about you?
I am going to go for Norwich, and I'm going to go for the winner of Leeds Sheffield United this weekend. I genuinely think that will be the difference, and I know you can't necessarily say that because the Champions League is Champions League. I wish, the Championship is so competitive, but realistically, they could both go and play Reading next week at home and lose 1-0. So, you know, that's just the way it is. And again, you look at the playoffs, and you know, there's almost a guarantee for West Brom that are in the playoffs, and that's still not good enough for their owners. And that, what a shocking decision to sack big Darren Moore.
I'd say it, but I really hope they don't go up now. I've never had anything against West Brom, but to do that to a manager who's brought so much stability to that football club after being relegated from the Premier League, and you can't underestimate how hard it is for a team coming down to do that. You look at the amount of teams who find themselves in that Championship now who've come down from the Premier League and who've struggled to get back up, and he's got them in a position that I honestly think if you'd have offered the board that at the start of the season, then they probably would have taken it. Yeah. But unfortunately, they've got greedy, and regardless of how bad the performances may have been in recent weeks, you got to stick with him, because the players will continually give everything for him for the rest of the games this season.
Yeah, I agree. You've then got Middlesbrough, who you'd expect to be in there. Pulis knows the situation better than anyone, but equally, they don't fill you with a huge amount of confidence that they can get any further than they did last year, where obviously they failed to make the final, losing to Villa in the playoff semi-finals. And then I think the real battle is for the last spot. Derby are in there at the moment, but again, not in great form. Bristol City, after winning every game they played for kind of 2 months, they haven't won in 4. Forest under O'Neill and Keane have a decent chance, just 2 points outside the playoffs. And then a point between them, you've got Villa and Birmingham, Preston and Hull, and there's it could literally be anyone. You know, I would love to see Villa in there again, but there's so much that's kind of out of our control as well that you can't necessarily say. But who, if you had to put your neck on the line, who are you saying for that final spot?
It's such a difficult one. I think Derby will drop out, and I honestly don't know who's going to get there. If you asked me to put my neck on the line, I'd probably go for Villa, on the basis that over the last couple of games you seem to have picked up, and Grealish could be massive between now and the end of the season. But I think it's difficult to count out Forest at the same time, because O'Neill going in there has made a massive difference just to the feel of the club. Yep. So the most important thing from a neutral perspective is the excitement that the Championship still brings year in, year out. And you never get a top 6 that's cut adrift from everybody else. You never get a top 2. I know obviously Wolves did it last season, but there was still competition for that second place, and it's such an exciting division that I guess everybody's just looking forward to seeing what's going to happen between now and the end of the season.
Everybody but me, really. I don't
enjoy it.
Yeah, I should enjoy it, but yeah, I think like you, I think Derby will drop out, and I think Forest are going to be up there, but we shall see. And down at the bottom, despite 4 draws in the last 5, Ipswich effectively down 12 points off safety. Bolton also just about still going, and then it's a battle between Rotherham, Millwall, Wigan and Reading. And Millwall currently have the worst form and are dropping like a stone, whereas the others are grinding out results. And I think Millwall, of any of them, you would say are the ones that would grind results out, but it's not happening. It's going to be very interesting. There's about 15 clubs that have still got things to play for in this season, and you have to admire the excitement of the Championship.
You do indeed.
Now let's move to Portugal, where a lot's changed for Sporting, I would say, since we last spoke.
Absolutely right. First of all, they were dumped unceremoniously out of Europe by Villarreal, and they did all right over there. They secured a 1-1 draw over in Spain, but the loss of Jefferson Nascimento to a 50th minute red card meant that they couldn't gain that all-important second away goal, which would have taken them through on the night. Since then, they've done all right. They've played three league games and picked up two victories over Portimonense and Boa Vista, respectively, as well as a point away at Boa Vista, where ex-Liverpool and Sunderland legend Sebastian Quatas picked up a red card for the Lions. That leaves them fourth in the league, as they pretty much have been since we started talking about them. 3 points behind third place Braga, and only 8 points behind the top two, Porto and Benfica. So it's still possible that they could break into that top three, yep. But it's probably going to be a difficult one for them because of the difference in quality between the top four and the rest of the teams in that league. There's some Friday night football for Sporting this week as they take on 8th placed Santa Clara at home, looking to get into that top three for the first time in 2019.
I might crack open a Super Bock or a Sagres and watch that on Friday night, I reckon.
Sounds very enjoyable.
Right, join us after the break. We're going to get to the rest of the Premier League.
Should have gone to Specsavers, Charlie, because I tell you what, he's not offside. Well, he's absolutely bang in line, not offside.
Well, maybe you should go also then, Jeff, because you couldn't see driving home the other night because you don't even wear your glasses in TV in case you get slagged off. So you just stick to Specsavers and I'll do the game.
Welcome back to the Sweeper Podcast Part 3, and it's time to go north to Newcastle, where they beat Everton 3-2 at home, but that doesn't tell the half of it, does it?
Can we talk about Jordan Pickford?
Yeah, Jordan, Jordan Matt Dawson Pickford.
Yeah, what on earth is he doing? A rugby tackle to concede a penalty after dropping the ball, then saves a penalty, then a parry for the equaliser, sticking his tongue out, being a little sod. I think he should have done better with the first that Newcastle scored as well. Just keep yourself out of the limelight, Jordan. Just do your job.
I think that was the problem. He let the emotion get to him, didn't he?
Yep.
Obviously, he's a Sunderland boy, he's a Sunderland fan, and it meant the world that his team were 2-0 up at Newcastle, and to be able to celebrate those little misdemeanours in front of the Gallagate meant probably more to him than the actual game, and that's where you cross a line, and that's a problem. Professionally, you shouldn't approach it like that. If you want to enjoy the game afterwards when you've got the 3 points, if you want to rub it in then, that's fine, but I think his concentration needs work, and I don't think he's had a very good season where everybody expected him to kick on since the World Cup, but you'd argue he's probably not the best English goalkeeper in the Premier League at this moment.
No, I'd agree. You know, you only have to look at certainly Tom Heaton's performances. He's been absolutely outstanding, and I think Pickford's probably got age on his side more than anything else, but equally I think if you're looking for a kind of calm head behind you in defence, I think you can't look any further than Tom Heaton. But that said, I think we have to give a hell of a lot of credit to Newcastle. Superb result and a great comeback as well. It's something they've not done for, I think, about 16 years or something like that, where they've come from 2 goals behind to win. And they were sloppy in the first half, but they stuck to their guns. They kept playing a direct style. And in Rondon and Perez being the focal points, they're not spectacular, they're not very flair driven, it's fair to say, but they're effective.
Yeah, and that first goal that they scored was a brilliant one. There was about 3 1-2s in there.
Yeah,
it's a really good finish from Rondon, somebody who's been a solid signing from West Brom, and
yes,
they will look to turn that loan into a permanent deal at the end of the season, I've got no doubt, because he's been somebody that they've been able to build an attack around. And with Almiron coming in of late, they've looked a lot more potent than they have been for the majority of the season. They don't score many goals, Newcastle. I think out of the teams in the bottom half, they're in the bottom three or four in terms of chances converted. So it will be of great sort of relief to those fans that they finally seem to have somebody there now who they can rely on for goals. And the team spirit that they showed was massive. And I really enjoy the way that Rafa Benitez celebrates at the end of the game when they've won the game, where he just takes his glasses off and slips them gently into his
job
jacket pocket.
Done.
Yeah, and I think they'll be absolutely fine, Newcastle. I know that obviously teams around them won this weekend, as we mentioned earlier, but they're a team who will grind out results. I think they've won 5 on the bounce at home now, and that's not a sign of a team that's going to get relegated.
Well, no, they've always got a chance at home, and they have as much experience as pretty much anyone else at being in this position at the stage of the season as well. And, you know, with Benitez at the helm, you do think they'll be okay. And, you know, they're very close. They're still in touching distance of everyone below them. But, yeah, I mean, they could beat anybody at home, and that is the key, whereas I think most of the clubs below them, despite this weekend, I think could always struggle against any opposition.
Absolutely right. We need to talk about Everton, unfortunately. Everton, they've flattered to deceive pretty much all season. Do they write it off and start again? I mean, I personally think they should keep hold of Marco Silva. I think he needs longer than he's had so far. He's been at so many clubs in the past, and it's normally been the fast start which has propelled his success. But obviously, it's not worked that way at Everton. I don't know what your thoughts are.
No, I think they should keep him as well. And ultimately, they've sacrificed a lot to get him as well, and spent a lot of money this season. So, unless they're getting into the Europa League, which is tough, it's tough for anyone, then as long as they're not in a relegation battle, then realistically, they're all right. But I would say surely they've got a good enough squad to not have to spend a load of money again this summer. And I think that's crucial, you know, a bit of consistency. That's probably what Everton have lacked over the last kind of 2 or 3 years. And if you look back at the David Moyes era, he was in charge for a long time, but also had a squad that was very settled, and they built a particular team spirit where they were happy to play against anyone, and, you know, they would punch above their weight. And I think that's what Everton need to do. They need to accept the fact that to be able to progress, they are going to have to punch above their weight, because the teams above them, that top six, really have pulled away over the last couple of seasons. And I think if you look at the sides around Everton, there's not anyone that stands out as someone that will necessarily challenge that top six. Wolves have done very well, but there's still a long way for them to go. Watford, Leicester, you could argue both have their moments, but likewise, they shouldn't be jumping any further ahead than Everton. So I think they have to take stock in the summer, but I think taking stock for them means let's just be patient, let's give them another season, and we'll see where we are. But 9 points off the relegation zone, 20 points off sixth, isn't pretty reading.
Tells you a lot, doesn't it? Yeah. I think that we need to update everybody with the final update of the Richarlison charity bet that we had. And I'd like to say season-long, it's not been season-long, it's been the winter-long charity bet. Came to an end a couple of midweeks ago when Everton faced Cardiff, and it was Richarlison's final opportunity to get to the magic mark of 8 goals. And it ended in disappointment, not for us, but for listener Eddie Lee, who had put his money where his mouth was. Richarlison didn't really manage to score enough goals, let's say, over that winter period. And obviously he grabbed a goal in the game against Newcastle on the weekend, but it was too little too late. And Marco Silva actually took him off in that game at Cardiff. So I don't know if any of our listeners know Marco Silva and maybe had a word in his ear about the bet, but if they did, thank you very much. What it does mean is that some money will be winging its way over to the Samaritans as a result of that. It's a great cause, and I think at this point we should probably say good luck to Chris Platt, who's another listener of ours, who's well and truly representing all that's good in the world when he runs the London Marathon in aid of the charity later in the year. So well done, Eddie, for putting your money where your mouth is, and well done, Platty, for your continued training in what will be a big, big day in, I think it's April, the London Marathon.
Yeah, it's just horrendous. I couldn't think of anything worse. I genuinely could not think of any more ways to torture myself than that.
Villa losing at Birmingham?
I'd rather that.
You'd rather than run a marathon?
Yeah. I'd be sick all over myself. After about 3 miles, I'd just be on my ass.
Okay, well,
so even more credit to Chris Platt. Get donating. We'll be putting links out in the near future.
Absolutely right. We should move on to the derby that's not really a derby, but it is a derby. Crystal Palace 1, Brighton 2. A huge result for Brighton here. Again, when looking at the other results, it's kept their head above water. And not only that, but it kind of drags Palace back into it now that they're level on points.
Yeah, absolutely. And you'd fancy Palace here on paper. I think they would have been huge favourites. And they're wasteful at times. They looked a little sloppy and just not their day, you suspect. But Brighton, they got probably a stroke of luck with the first. And
not half.
The second goal was the goal of the weekend. And, you know, Knockhart's been fantastic over the last couple of weeks. And it couldn't have come at a better time. They've been crying out for someone to just give them the creative spark that they were lacking. There was a hell of a lot of reliance on Glenn Murray, and you know, he's the perfect antidote for this. The goal itself was a stunner, and I think anything that flies in off the post from distance looks great. And I think the biggest question mark around Knockout of the weekend was, should he have been on the pitch?
I don't think so. I think it was a bad challenge. I don't care what minute it happens in. If that happens in the 89th minute, I think it's a red card, and I don't think that's fair from a Crystal Palace point of view. But obviously he's got away with it, and he's then managed the game in the correct way. And I think that Brighton will be very, very relieved, because I thought that they would pick up and have themselves well clear at this point, but they're well and truly in that.
And, you know, you look at that decision as well. We've spoken earlier in the show about decisions and moments within a season. If Knockout goes off there, 10 men for the whole game, he's suspended for 3 games as well. And, you know, he has been that bright spark. I do still worry about Brighton. I do still think that they've potentially got a fairly limited squad. And I think when you're looking for teams to grind out results, I'm not sure they're necessarily... ones that you would kind of hang your hats on. Again, you know, we talked about Cardiff and the Neil Warnock factor. We've not necessarily had to see it a lot from Chris Hughton and Brighton over the last few seasons, so I think it's going to be an interesting one. Whether they go down or whether I think they will, I'm not sure they will, but I am worried.
Yeah, and looking at their fixtures, obviously they're still in the FA Cup, Brighton. They have got Cardiff, Southampton and Bournemouth to play, but then on the other hand they've got Tottenham, Wolves and Arsenal and Manchester City, so they've not really got that many easy games. Yeah. Because the games against the sides at the bottom, they'll be scrapping for their lives as well. You want to be playing mid-table sides, really, at this stage of the season. And I think that your fear for Brighton may well be founded, but it's obviously a great win for them, and they'll be looking up for the time being, for sure.
Palace, you look at them, and on paper, they should be battering teams at times. You know, they've got so much pace and power, and they just struggle to click, and generally, they're defensively sound to take away this weekend. And I wonder what happens with them going forward. You know, do they push on with a couple of signings? Is it a different manager, perhaps? A slightly different direction? Or do they settle for it? Or am I just massively way off on this?
I think that Palace know that they're unlikely to ever really break into the top six. For them, it's got to be trying to finish in the top half. And to do that, they need to keep their key players fit, and that's what they've struggled with season upon season. They need a goal scorer, and Batshuayi looked like he may be that man over the first couple of games. Obviously, he didn't look particularly good or particularly mobile in this game, and that will be a worry because he's not played a huge amount of football this season. But I think that Palace need to take stock in the summer, as most teams will do in the Premier League. I definitely wouldn't get rid of Roy Hodgson. I think that he's the right man for the club for the time being, and it might be that they have one good season every 5, and if that's the case, from a Palace point of view, you'd take it, because you'd imagine that those fans were probably worried that they'd never get back into the Premier League
a few years back. Good season for Crystal Palace?
I think avoiding relegation is a good season. I don't think that they have the resources to warrant anything more than that. I think anything else is a bonus, but when I say one good season in 5, I mean that might be finishing in the top 10 versus finishing 16th, 17th, as they may have done in seasons past. But there's the difficulty for Palace is the likelihood is they'll lose Wan-Bissaka in the summer, and they will be a selling club, and that's the gulf in the Premier League has now started to become even more apparent than ever, and Wolves are only really just hanging on to the coattails of the top 6, and you look how much money they're spending. So it will become like this. It will become a two-tiered division, and it will be a case of trying to win that second tier for those teams down there.
You mentioned Wolves there, picked up a point away at Chelsea, and I think for Chelsea it could be an important point. You know, they'll be disappointed to not build on some good results in recent weeks and win this comfortably, and you know, it's fair to say it's been an interesting season so far for them. A lot of discussion points, a lot of narrative behind the season, none more so than that Carabao Cup final that maybe just kind of sums it all up, really.
Yeah, it's bonkers. It was crazy at the time, and it's probably a good thing that we didn't get the opportunity to record straight after that, because I think since the dust settled, it's something that obviously a lot of people have forgotten about now because other incidents have happened. But what it does still show at Chelsea is that the players unfortunately have too much power for that football club, and until that flips on its head, they're unlikely to ever get back to where they were a couple of seasons ago. And that would be a worry if you were a Chelsea fan, because you want the best players there, but naturally if that means that you're not going to get the best managers, you're going to struggle to finish as high up the league as your competition.
I can see them struggling to get in the Champions League, and I just, there's something about it that I think is just set up for like a bittersweet qualification to get into the Champions League through winning the Europa League. And I think it's going to be an interesting one, because if they don't get in the Champions League, they're already likely to lose Eden Hazard. Obviously Real Madrid are going through some major changes at the moment, and he's the one that they're likely to bring in. And he showed this weekend that he's the kind of bright spark. He's the one that you can almost rely on to pull something out of the bag from absolutely nothing.
Yeah, if he doesn't go this summer, I think that shows a lack of ambition from his point of view. He's getting towards his sort of late 20s now, and he's got the opportunity to join one of the biggest football clubs in the world in Real Madrid. It's set up for him to go there, and he may love living in London, but he's not going to win anything with Chelsea in the next couple of years, any major honours anyway. I mean, you currently sit in sixth in the Premier League, and that's not good enough for somebody who considers himself in the same breath as Messi and Ronaldo. So if he really does, then he needs to challenge himself at that top table and go over to Real Madrid and see if he can try and win them their first title in a long time.
It was typical Chelsea, really, though. You know, they were fairly simple to play against. They didn't really show any massive ambition to change things up. You know, Wolves are very organised, made it very difficult for Chelsea, but they still should be pressing teams more, especially at home. You know, even the bigger sides, you know, Sarri wasn't impressed and wasn't happy with Wolves, but I thought you have to give them big credit, because whilst Chelsea didn't necessarily test them, they stuck to their game plan. And I don't know if you saw a match of the day, they showed the average touch map or the average position map, and it was just like the formation they'd set up with at the start of the game. And there's so much discipline within that side, and Nuno's got them playing exactly how he wants them to play. And I think it's going to be an interesting couple of years for them, because I think if they do bring in more talent, which I'm sure inevitably they will do, they've got a real chance to be those ones. You know, we spoke about Everton. They could be the ones that are pushing that top six.
Absolutely right. Yeah, I think that Wolves deserve a lot of credit. They've been brilliant this season. They've been a breath of fresh air. And I think it gives credence to teams who come up into the Premier League and do spend big. I mean, you look at what Fulham did and you look at what Wolves did in the summer, and the difference between those two teams is chalk and cheese. So there's a model there, and if you're able to get it right, then it's a possibility for a club who are currently, like Aston Villa, in the Championship. If you went up next season, there's nothing to say that you couldn't have a season like Wolves the year after.
Absolutely. Well, on the other side of that, you mentioned Fulham. They lost 3-1 at Leicester City, and they've had a change in manager. Claudio Ranieri is gone, and I think they're possibly looking a little bit more long term with Scott Parker, certainly for the time being, who's very assured. And I think, you know, as a player and how he spoke as a player, you could imagine him doing all right. And were he to be the long term option, it's going to be tough. And I think that's the biggest question mark with Fulham. They've got a lot of players they brought in last summer, and I think a lot of them could move on as well.
I think that they will have to have a large clear out in the summer. I imagine that the majority of players went to Fulham because they would have had release clauses in their contracts, and you know that you're going to get a big payday for a year regardless, and then you'll be able to leave for a decent price. So I go back to your Scott Parker point. I think that he's got potential to do okay, but then you look at what's happened to Darren Moore at West Brom, and less players are going to want to get into management if that's the way that you treat a manager. And Scott Parker's given a huge amount of his career to that football club, and I just hope that if he is given the opportunity, that they do look long term instead of just sacking him, because it doesn't look like they're going to bounce back straight away. It's interesting to see whether Shahid Khan's going to quite happily go along in the Championship again, or whether he's going to try and throw more money at it to come back up. And is he now going to put more of his eggs into his NFL basket and forget about the Premier League? It's going to be a massive summer for Fulham, let's say, and it's just disappointing that they had a real go in the summer spending all that money. And it's ended how it has done.
Yeah, I mean, I'm gutted, because obviously they were great in that playoff final, and I'm not bitter about it at all, but it's all changed at Leicester as well. We said about Brendan Rodgers coming in earlier in the show, and probably not a huge surprise. We thought it may come a little later, possibly in the summer, but probably a good appointment at a good time, I would say.
Yeah, I think that he fits Leicester like a glove. He's ambitious. He wants to progress in his managerial career, and he sees himself as a top six Premier League manager, and he'll have the opportunity to do that. Leicester's already talks of the amount of money that they might spend in the summer. And you looked at this game against Fulham, and as much as they won it relatively comfortably, you look at a lot of that Leicester squad and they are getting to the stage where you may consider that they're over the hill. Somebody like Wes Morgan's probably not got a lot of years left at him at the top level. And even Vardy, pace is his main attribute, and although it looks like he's not lost any of that at this stage, you never know. He's into his 30s now, and yep, you don't see many players at that age reliant on that as their main strength. So I think Rodgers has always done okay in the transfer window, and I think he's due to link up with the transfer specialist that he had up with him at Celtic, and they unearthed some gems there, so he'll be looking to do the same at Leicester and really move them on to the next level. And I think Leicester fans will be pleased as well, because the Claude Puel signing, although it was probably the right one at the time, it turned sour because of the type of football that he played there. So they'll be looking forward to getting their football club back, given how great they were on the eye when they won the league.
And I think with Rodgers, as you said, he is ambitious, and I think, you know, he will... This is the right club at the right time from the right level, but he will look at this as a stepping stone to get back into a top six club. And, you know, he didn't do a terrible job with Liverpool. You know, he left with his reputation intact, and, you know, he's done very, very well at Celtic, and has chosen to leave them at, you could argue, you know, probably the most competitive league they've had up there for kind of 6-7 years. And you know, he's shown that he's willing to take that jump if it comes along for him.
Absolutely. Talking of taking that jump, Huddersfield may well be jumping off the Premier League train and onto the Championship platform if they continue the way that they've been going. It's really hard to be positive about Huddersfield at the moment, isn't it? Obviously, this game at home to Bournemouth is something that they would have been looking forward to. It's a game that they would have been looking to try and get something from, give them a boost. And although they've got a very small chance of staying in the Premier League, even a goal at this stage would make those Huddersfield fans feel a little bit better about how that team has been performing.
Yeah, the manager was right to be disappointed. You know, he's already demanding more. He's trying to implement a style that the players are comfortable with now and into next season. And if they're not reacting to that now, then they're in a bit of trouble come next season as well. You know, he's effectively building them ready so that on day one next year in the Championship, assuming that's where they're playing, they're ready to go and they're ready to give it another crack again. And whether that's personnel, whether that's just, you know, they can't quite get their head around that fact at the moment, I'm not sure. But I think he's come in with a reputation similar to the last manager, and I think a similar kind of style and approach as well. And it shouldn't be too difficult for these players to pick that up, and it's a worry they're not doing that.
I suppose the one good thing from a Huddersfield point of view is in a chairman like Dean Hoyle, you would imagine that he probably will reinvest that money next season that they'll get from the parachute payments. So it might look bleak at the moment, but if you'd have asked Huddersfield fans a few years ago, would you be in the Premier League at this stage with a pretty good chance of bouncing straight back, I think that they would have taken it. We need to talk about Bournemouth as well. Obviously, they ended a run of 9 consecutive away defeats, and they looked good value for the win. They created a lot of space. I thought that Callum Wilson, Josh King, Ryan Fraser all looked very good, and it kind of took me back to the start of the season where Bournemouth looked like they might be able to challenge for the top 6 or 7, and those three players were integral to the type of football that Eddie Howe was playing at that stage. And obviously, injuries have played a part, and it's frustrating when you've got a squad of Bournemouth size where one injury can make a huge difference to your season. But if they can keep those players fit for the rest of this season and going into next season, then they could perform well enough to finish in the top 10. I think they're about 12th at the moment, yep, and that's probably about right for that football club.
Yeah, speaking of the job that Eddie Howe's done though, and where they are in the league, he's been credited by Bournemouth Council. He's going to be awarded the Freedom of Bournemouth.
That's not something to be overly proud. No, I'm joking. It's a nice place, and I think that he deserves every accolade he gets, because they are by far the smallest team that's ever competed at Premier League level, and to do it season in, season out without any real threat of relegation is testament to the hard work that he puts in. I'd really like to see him test himself at a top 6 club, but yes, I'm just not convinced that call will ever come.
No, we shall wait and see. But that is all for the Premier League. Join us after the break, where we are taking a trip to the quiz that's been so long in coming, and I can't bloody wait. There's nothing left to talk.
Let's get Welcome back to the final part of this week's Sweeper podcast, and it's almost time for the quiz. But before we get on to that, Mitch is going to give you a little reminder of how you can get in contact with us.
You can get us on Twitter at The Sweep Pod, Instagram and Facebook, search The Sweep Podcast, and email thesweeperpodcast@gmail.com and get us all over the airways. You can get us on iTunes where you can subscribe, rate and review. Please keep the reviews coming. 5-star ratings would be much appreciated. And I think we now need a little update on the Fantasy Premier League, don't we?
We do indeed, Mitch. And it's time to give out February's Manager of the Month prize, which, as everyone knows, is footballing kudos. And this month, the prize goes to somebody who's worked very hard all season at Fantasy Premier League. And that's you, Mitch.
Yes.
And you won it at an absolute canter, a whopping total of 297 points for the month of February. Saw you finish 10 points clear of second place Matthew Prince, and for anyone who knows him, that's a turn up for the books that he's still competing this side of Christmas. And our England correspondent Steve Grant's team, Locomotive Vodka, they took third place on 279 points. The overall standings have brought a bit more excitement of late, finally. After what seems like months, Mitch, you've finally been toppled from the top spot by Frank-Louis Priard and his team, Bipolar FPL Disorder. Now, there's only one point in it, though, so plenty of opportunity for you to regain the lead before the end of the season. You two are miles clear of the chasing pack, and I find myself as a member of that down in seventh position. So I think you've taken Fantasy Premier League to another level this season. I was talking to one of our friends about this while I was out with him the other day, and I'm not convinced how you've done it. I don't really understand whether you've become part of some sort of inner circle that nobody else knows about, but you just seem to pick the right players at the right time.
Well, what can I say? A lot of scouting's been done, a lot of scouting missions. I like how you have chosen to look at the current standings to tell me that I'm in second place rather than the end of the month standings, but that's absolutely fine. That you know, if you want to get your small glories elsewhere,
Mitch, you've got to give the people what they want, and there's no given how long it's been since our last episode, I thought it was only right to bring people up to speed, and you should be all for that as somebody who strives to be first place.
Let's give the people what they want. Let's give them some quiz. You are winning 24-19, and I am asking the questions, and yeah, it's going to be interesting on this. So, S is for Sven. Sven-Göran Eriksson capped 14 players just once for England. Can you name one of them? It's that simple. Just to clarify, some of the players did go on to get more caps or had caps previous to him coming in. But 14 players, I just need a name.
Oh, God. David Nugent.
David Nugent is not on the list, I'm afraid. I think he may have been in just before Sven, or maybe just after.
Do you know, I was going to say Michael Ricketts before David
Michael
Nugent.
Ricketts was in there. So you've got Darren Bent, Lee Bowyer, Alan Thompson, Michael Ball, Gavin McCann, Michael Ricketts, David Dunn, Francis Jeffers, Anthony Gardner, Rob Green, Richard Wright, Darren Anderson, Ian Walker, Theo Walcott.
Gutted.
G is for goals. Or lack of, in this case. Which club scored the fewest goals in a single Premier League season?
Derby County.
Correct. In 2007-2008. That's one. One out of two.
Yeah.
E is for Europe. No, it's not a Brexit question. Topical.
Good.
It's about the UEFA Cup and the newer form, the Europa League. Four English clubs have lost in the final of the competition and have never won it. Name two of them.
Four English clubs have lost in the final of the competition and never won it.
Yeah.
So I can't go with a club that has won
it. So if Chelsea have won it but they've lost in the final,
then
they're out.
Right, so Middlesbrough and Fulham.
Correct. Straight in there. Do you know the others? One was definitely in our lifetime while we were watching football. In 2000.
I feel like there's another club who
I believe they might have lost to Galatasaray in the final.
Oh, no, I don't know. Go on.
Arsenal.
All right.
And Wolves in 1972. So that's two out of three. It's looking good. Right. D is for Dutch. Listen carefully.
There
are five Dutchmen to play for Arsenal in the Premier League. You have three options. You can either give me three of the five for 1 point, four of the five for 2 points, or three for all five.
Do you mean five for all three?
Yes, that's exactly what I mean.
I was going to say
so
that,
you are listening carefully. I nearly caught you up.
Suddenly got easier.
So I need a quick snap answer in 3 seconds. Can you name 3, 4, or 5?
I can name 4.
4. For 2 points, name 4.
4 Dutch Arsenal players
yep.
to have played for them in the Premier
yep.
League. I'm struggling now. Robin van Persie.
Correct.
Mark Overmars.
Correct.
Dennis Bergkamp.
Correct.
So obviously they're the straightforward ones. Yep. Which other Dutch players have played for Arsenal? Oh, this is bad,
isn't
it? Bear
in mind, if you don't get it, you get no points.
Yeah. Is there somebody quite... I can't really ask any for any clues, can I?
No, you can't ask any questions.
Dutch players to play for Arsenal. I've gone completely. My head has gone. I think he only played for Chelsea. Jeffrey Broomer ever play for Arsenal?
No, he didn't, I'm afraid. No,
I'm done. Who was it?
Giovanni Van Bronckhorst.
Oh, no.
And Glenn Helder.
Wouldn't have got Glenn Helder. We could have been here all day. I like your, it's a good question. I like it.
Good. Final question, 50-50, A is for appearances, and on the theme of Dutchman, who has more Premier League appearances out of Edwin van der Sar and Dennis Bergkamp?
Oh, another great question. I think the answer is Edwin van der Sar.
You are incorrect. Mic drop. Dennis Bergkamp, 315, Edwin van der Sar, 313.
Bloody hell, that's a close one, wasn't it?
Yes.
Well, I'll take my 2 points and I'll move on from there.
How good is it to be back?
It was great. I really enjoyed it, and it's not going to be as long between the next episode.
No.
We will speak to you soon. And like Mitch said earlier, get in touch with us. Let us know what you've been up to in our absence. And we've got another little gap between the next round of Premier League fixtures. I think there's a few this weekend, but obviously it moves on to the FA Cup will probably be the main focus, and then it's international break. So there's going to be a lot to talk about whenever we do record the next episode, and we look forward to speaking to a lot of you between now and then.
Thank you very much. Sayonara.
Goodbye.